and the subtitle is A Self-Examination. So today I'm going to be talking about a book of the Bible that seemed to be somewhat dark and not very uplifting at first glance. Now, in my opinion, it made the reader examine their life. And the word that came up frequently was vanity. The point that seemed to be made was that we are born, we live life, and then we die. What happens between life and death in this world, and for this worldly life, it could kind of be summed up by the word vanity, or some translations say futility, others say temporary, and some say meaningless. Here's just a few of those verses. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Here's another one. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. Another one. Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done, and the labor which had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. And the last one, then I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity. But you know, the book also has some very positive things as well. And these kind of become the verses that we are very well associated with. These we kind of use in our conversation with others. And so what are those? Verse one, there is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every event under heaven. How about another positive one? Two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. And another positive one, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance. And then our last one that we've got quoted here, the conclusion when all has been heard is fear God and keep his commandments because this applies to every person. So in case you haven't figured out the book I'm referring to, it's the book of Ecclesiastes. This book is one of the three books of wisdom. Now you may include other books and say, well, yeah, but what about this one? But these are predominantly accepted as books of wisdom. Our Bible highlights the three books of wisdom as kind of three different aspects or periods of life which deal with a relationship to God. Proverbs, Job, and Ecclesiastes are the three books of wisdom. Now, you might have a different opinion from me, but I see these three books describing wisdom in three periods of a person's life. Okay, now we got video. Okay, there we go. Sister Karen stepped in alongside me, and she says, well, what about that button? So anyway, now we got video. So here I am. We're going to look at Proverbs 1:1-7. And here's what Proverbs says. Now, remember, this is a book of wisdom. Proverbs provides life's lessons for a wise and a moral existence. It instructs us how everyone should honor God and other people for a better life. The first chapter tells us where we should begin in our pursuit of wisdom and knowledge. And that's why we call it a book of wisdom. So let's start here. The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, to know wisdom and instruction, to discern the sayings of understanding, to receive instruction in wise behavior, righteousness, justice, and equity, to give prudence to the naive, to the youth, knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear and increase in learning, and a man of understanding will acquire wise counsel. to understand a proverb and a figure, the words of the wise and their riddles. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. Great, great lesson there in those first seven scriptures of Proverbs. So these are kind of like early life lessons, and the recurring theme throughout the book, it reminds the reader to follow a certain path in life to acquire wisdom and knowledge. And good listening leads to good knowledge, which then leads to good wisdom. For a better life, you really should follow Proverbs 1:1-7. Okay. I'm not advancing.
Did you hit your space bar? Does it work?
No.
Exit full screen then.
No, wait a minute. Okay. I don't know why this is not advancing, but it's not. Just a moment, I have a little technical difficulty. Okay, Brother Joe, I'm going to just continue on. For some reason, my PowerPoint won't advance. So I'll just continue on and we'll go without the PowerPoint. And I'll just go ahead and go through the talk. The next book is the book of Job. Now Job teaches that God is sovereign within his creation. And he allows experiences to polish us, and therefore he should not be questioned. We go to Job 36:22-26 to kind of get a little feel or an understanding of Job. Behold, God is exalted in his power. There, we'll go just with the video and the PowerPoint, we'll just kind of go without. Okay, who has appointed him his way?
And John, can you hear me, John?
Yes, I can.
Try one more thing. If you would stop sharing, click that red stop share at the top of your screen. Do you see that?
Okay.
Right now, get to your PowerPoint file and close PowerPoint, and then open it up again and see if that will enable you to. And then you'll have to share your screen again once you get PowerPoint open the second time.
Okay, let's see what we get. Oh, okay. So let's see what we got here. And there. And now I'm going to go to.
So try advancing your slides before you screen share. Can you make PowerPoint work properly just as you look at it?
Okay, let me see what I can do here. And let's see. Yeah, I can advance it without screen share.
Okay, so, but now if you would share your screen, click the green button at the bottom. And then when that pops up, you'll see the little menu there with your PowerPoint slide in it. Click on that and then do what you did before. Okay, we can see your screen now. We see the Job slide.
Okay, can you see that?
Yeah, so now see if you can advance to the slide you want to be on. Yep, it's looking good here, so just keep going until you are where you want to be. There we go.
Okay. All right. Technology is great when it works. Okay, so let me go back here a little bit. And I'm going to read from Job chapter 36, verses 22 to 26, and it kind of give us a flavor of what Job was all about. Starting in verse number 22. Behold, God is exalted in his power. Who is a teacher like him? Who has appointed him his way? And who has said, you have done wrong? Remember that you should exalt his work of which men have sung. All men have seen it. Man beholds from afar. Behold, God is exalted, and we do not know him. The number of his years is unsearchable. You see, this book looks at someone's life that is experiencing trouble, and they want to know why. Why is this happening? And this is kind of the experience that Job had. They want to know who's responsible for their trouble. These are kind of midlife lessons. We do not understand everything about God or the universe, or that some trouble is just happenstance of life. Therefore, fear God and give honor to him and his creation. And do not rely on your corrupted reasoning, but trust God that he will bless you and keep you in his care. Then we get to Ecclesiastes. This is the third book of wisdom. And this is a book that we'll focus on today. Ecclesiastes, it kind of puts us into a self-examination mode. And it challenges us to come to some valuable conclusions about our life. And it talks about our life under the sun and the relationship that we can have with God. It tries to answer the age-old question, what is the meaning of life lived to an old age? It provides lessons to a young person as well that were learned over a lifetime of successes, failures, and regrets by someone who learned them too late to make a difference in avoiding some of the trouble in their own life. So these were kind of like end-of-life observations. Ecclesiastes begins with the introduction of two people, the author and a preacher. We go to Ecclesiastes 1:1-2, and we read, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What did the author of Ecclesiastes point out in an anonymous preacher's journey through life that helped the author arrive at some lessons that he felt compelled to share? Because this isn't like the preacher is writing his own words, but there's an author that is also involved in this, and the author is the one who is writing this book. It was this unknown preacher's experiences through the ups and downs of life that taught the author how to have a purposeful existence in a crazy, sinful world. Much of what we read in his observations they're seemingly kind of pessimistic about life in general. So why the pessimism? Or is it really pessimism? That'll be our journey today. We're going to look at four questions, and we want to try and answer the four questions in our study of this valuable book of the Bible. Question one, who is the author and the unknown preacher? Two, can we really agree with the unknown preacher's opening statement in chapter one? Vanity of vanities, all is vanity in life. Three, what is the meaning of life according to this book? And four, what is the concluding lesson? But before we answer our questions, let's look at an overview of Ecclesiastes. And we're going to see that the basic structure of Ecclesiastes begins with an introduction to the book in chapter one and gives some concluding thoughts in chapter 12. That's how the book is laid out. So, sandwiched in between these two chapters are the lessons the preacher or the teacher wants to share with you, the student. Chapter one begins with what appears to be kind of a pessimistic outlook of life. It's kind of a view which says, why even try to make sense of things that are temporary and quickly forgotten? Everything is futile anyway. Everything is meaningless. Let's look at the opening of chapter one. Chapter one, verses 2 to 3. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What advantage does a man have in his work, which he does under the sun? But as you can see, once we get to chapter 12, which is also up on your screen there, we get to chapter 12, verses 13 and 14, and we kind of see a little bit of a different attitude about life. Here, in Ecclesiastes 12, 13, and 14, we read, the conclusion, when all has been heard, when you've gone through all these chapters, 1 through 11, and into chapter 12, he says, but the conclusion when all has been heard is, fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. The key here, of course, is to keep God's commandments, to fear God. And that's the key to these scriptures. That's what he's pointing out. So what we want to know is what happened between chapters 1 and 12 that seems to have given the preacher enough lessons that brought him to a valuable conclusion for a meaningful life. Well, let's start with our first question. That's always the best place to start. Always start with question one, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to start with question one. Who is the author and the unknown preacher? And you're going to say, well, gosh, that's pretty apparent. Well, there's no question about it. But really, if we look in chapter one, it really doesn't tell you who the author is, and it doesn't tell you who the preacher is. So here, we're going to take a look at this now. Who is the author and the unknown preacher? The first person we come to is someone named Preacher. And you see, the name Preacher comes from the Hebrew word ohelet, which is translated into the Greek word. And now here that opens up a lot of mystery here. It translates into the Greek word Ecclesiastes. And it means one who addresses an assembly. And thus, preacher, or better, teacher. The preacher is given credit for the observation and life experiences in the book. An anonymous author gives us the lessons that were learned by a preacher in kind of an orderly arrangement of life's observations and personal experiences. And it is this author who describes the lessons of the preacher throughout the entire book. In chapter one, we're introduced to them along with an introduction to the main theme, which we're about to read. The author, who's quoting the words of the preacher throughout the book, he makes a general statement about life he sees completely shattered in pieces. And it's like shattered, and it's laid out on the floor, and he's trying to make sense of it. The life he's reflecting upon did not go in a straight line. It didn't go in a kind of a linear direction. It kind of went forward a bit, then sideways, then left, then forward a while, and then sideways right for a while, until it eventually crashed into pieces. He saw it in front of him. Ecclesiastes 1, 1 to 3. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What advantage does man have in his work, which he does under the sun? So the preacher frames his view of life around this one word, vanity. And from a first full reading of chapter one, we're left with the impression that the preacher sees life as an arrangement of accumulated possessions, experiences, and observations that are fleeting. He placed too much importance on the things that were fleeting. They were like a wind or a breeze that's momentarily felt and then it's gone. The preacher then transitions into the next feeling that he's experiencing. He feels powerless to change the course of his life, even though he has a great deal of wisdom. Ecclesiastes 1, 12 to 16. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of man to be afflicted with. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. Also, later in the book, in chapter 12, he has a feeling of some accomplishment. This gives us evidence who the preacher is. Up to this point, we don't know who the preacher is. It doesn't specifically say that, but it kind of gives us characteristics and maybe titles that the preacher has. The author conveys to the reader what the preacher's purpose in life has been as he saw it. In addition to being a wise man, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, and he pondered and searched out and arranged many proverbs. So who's the preacher? Well, we believe that the preacher is Solomon. That we can pretty much conclude from this. But who is this author? And we still don't really know. We know that Solomon wrote several books, namely Proverbs and Song of Solomon, which contain a collection of wise advice to the reader. He was also a king in Jerusalem and one of the 20 sons of David. The preacher says he has more wisdom than all who ruled over Jerusalem before him, namely his father David. So Solomon isn't mentioned, but we have strong evidence to support the claim that we are listening to the wisdom of Solomon. So why not identify Solomon as the preacher in verse 1? Why didn't it say that this is Solomon who's teaching the preacher instead of masking him behind the character of a preacher? And just one thought, and you may have other thought. I'm not adamant about it, but one thought came to my mind was perhaps we're to look at him as a preacher, and in this sense, a life coach, instead of looking at him as a king. You see, as a king, he fell from grace through his poor choices and willing disobedience to the wisdom that God had provided him to rule over Israel. The book is not written about a king who fell from grace, but it's written about a man who realized the most important things in life are not the things which gratify the flesh, but the most important thing is to honor God and fear God. Whether Solomon wrote this book or he dictated it to a scribe or it was written many years after Solomon's time, it doesn't change the wisdom in this book. It's apparent that we're being given a clear window view into the life lessons of Solomon and the wisdom on the lessons of life. As some have suggested, and if you can picture this, and if any of you have ever done this, but it's like an aged grandpa. It's like an aged grandpa sitting on the porch swing, talking to his grandchildren. And he's telling them about the wisdom he learned through life. He hopes that his stories of life can help his grandchildren. And he wants them to see the correct path to take in life. He even leaves words of wisdom for the young ones. Ecclesiastes 12, 1 and 4. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, when you will say, I have no delight in them. Before the sun and the light, the moon and the stars are darkened, and clouds return after the rain. In the day that the watchmen of the house tremble, and mighty men stoop, the grinding ones stand idle because they are few, and those who look through the windows grow dim. And the doors on the street are shut as the sound of the grinding mill is low. And one will arise at the sound of the bird, and all the daughters of song will sing softly. You see, experience is a great teacher. And it should be learned and shared with others. It's a common knowledge that Solomon was blessed by God with great wisdom. And the wealth from his wisdom was created for Israel. It's said that gold was as common as sand in the kingdom of Israel. Solomon had a relationship with God and seemingly everything that anyone would want. To have a relationship with God, that is what we want. But wisdom wasn't lacking, but he still fell from favor from his poor choices in life. His possessions and great wealth didn't save him from a fall from favor. If we did a study locally here in the book of Proverbs, and as we're going through Proverbs, we're wondering, well, look what he's writing here. These are great lessons, but seemingly it looks like he didn't even follow his own advice. And so that's kind of what you're left with. The answer to question one, who is the author and the unknown preacher? The author is unknown, and the preacher is probably Solomon. I don't close the door completely on the possibility it could be someone else, but I believe there is strong evidence to say the preacher is Solomon. Let's go on to question number two. Can we really agree with the unknown preacher's opening statement in chapter two? In chapter one. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity in life. And we'll begin to look at question two by first examining that word vanity. And I'm going to reread Ecclesiastes 1:1-3. The words of the preacher, the son of King David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What advantage does a man have in all his work, which he does under the sun? See, the word vanity is translated from the Hebrew word hubbel. And it describes something that's kind of short-lived. But even more than that, there's a characteristic of it. Let's look at hebel, which translated, we're going to see this word given to us through Strong's. And let me read what Strong says about this word. It says, it shows an emptiness or vanity. Figuratively, it's something transitory and unsatisfactory. It's often used as an adverb. It's also like smoke or like vapor. It could be visible to the eyes before it fades away, and it's no longer relevant, like the properties of smoke. Vanity is used 38 times and is therefore a recurring theme when the preacher's talking about the work of his hands, but it's never used to describe the work of God. So smoke gives us a very good visual of Hubble concerning its emptiness. You see, you can see smoke, but you can't take permanent possession of it. Concerning its transitory property or condition, you can save smoke in a jar, but eventually it'll fade away. Concerning its unsatisfactory value, you could save that jar of smoke and leave it to others in your will, but they might not value it as much as you. its value is uniquely appreciated by you, and then it fades away. Smoke is temporary, and it'll fade away in the breeze. Perhaps what the preacher wants us to see life as it's a period of collecting things, experiences, and observations, which are only temporary. They have their time in our life, but eventually that passes. And it is time for something else. Eventually they fade away and are replaced with other experiences. Life is like vapor. It's like smoke. The preacher's view of life seems to see all things in a moment in time. And then he sees things from a very transitory perspective. Ecclesiastes 2:15-17. Then I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity. For there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool. Inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten, and how the wise man and the fool alike die. Seems that though he's saying we're born, we live, and then we die. Whatever we do in life, it has value for us. Generations later, no one remembers the value you placed on your things or experiences. You know, if we visit the Salvation Army periodically and look over the things in there, and you know, the local Salvation Army store is full of things that someone bought at a high dollar price, and now it sits on the shelf waiting for someone to buy it for pennies on the dollar. It was valuable to you because it defined a point in your life that you treasured. No matter what you have under the sun, you are surely going to die, and those possessions have not defined who you were. What we prepare for our spiritual growth, though, remains. Death is an inevitable end of this life, and there is nothing we can do to change that. The rich, the poor, the wise, the smart, the mentally challenged, righteous or unrighteous, are all going to end up in the grave. The life you have in this world is like the mist or vapor the preacher refers to in chapter 1. You can't grab it and hold it because it will eventually fade away. In the New Testament book of James, he agrees with this analogy of a man's life compared to mist or vapor. James 4:14, yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. James is saying you don't know what's going to happen every day. Life is unpredictable and uncontrollable. You must keep God's will in your life and plan your life to include him. Included in the passage is the thought that our life resembles a vapor. James agrees with the preacher in his description of our life under the sun as being short. And then we get a time feature for all the commentary on life in chapter 1, verse 3. And the preacher isn't saying there's no purpose in life under the sun. The preacher doesn't see a great amount of value in creating wealth and possessions in the life we have under the sun. This was his time under the sun. The life we're living now in a fallen world is not the life that is eternally satisfying. We are living in a time under the sun. A life which focuses on the gratification of the flesh is temporary and is only valuable to us during our time under the sun. I believe our lesson is found in that statement. The answer to question 2, can we really agree with the unknown preacher's opening statement in chapter 1, vanity of vanities, all is vanity in life? Well, when we put it in context and timing, we can say that we kind of agree in part with the preacher. The things in this fallen world are fleeting and should not be given an excessive amount of value in our lifetime. Nevertheless, godly pursuits are always valuable, and they follow us into the kingdom of God. Apostle Paul supports that point in 1 Corinthians 15:58. Here he encourages us to pursue God, and it is never in vain. 1 Corinthians 15:58. I skipped ahead too far in that thing. 1 Corinthians 15:58 says, "Therefore, my beloved brothers and sisters, be firm, immovable, always excelling in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord." Strong statement. James also agrees on that point. We're blessed to follow the will and the pathway that God has provided for us. And as such, we are to consider God first in our planning. James 4:15-17. Instead, you ought to say, "If the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin." What is the meaning of life according to the book? Well, when we consider pleasure, possessions under the sun, do they provide a meaningful life? Sure, pleasure can be derived from possessions, but it's that sustainable formula for eternal pleasure and happiness. And we'd say, no, it does not. It does not provide eternal pleasure and happiness. What does the preacher say about this in chapter 2? What he says in chapter 2, "I said in mine heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure, and behold, this also is vanity." 2:4-6. "I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself, and I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees." Ecclesiastes 2:9-11. "Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not restrain my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. So I considered all my activities which my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was futility and striving after wind, and there was no benefit under the sun." Ecclesiastes 2:14-17. "The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness, and I myself perceived also that one event happeneth to them all. Then I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity. For there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool, inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten. And how the wise man and the fool alike die." And then all of this is summed up in verse 17 of chapter 2. And it's here that we can understand what the preacher is trying to say in the first two chapters of the book. Oop, 17, right at the bottom there of the screen. "So I hated life, for the work which I had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is vanity and striving after wind." That's kind of an interesting statement that he makes there in 17, to start 17. "So I hated life." See, the preacher tells us that life is very unpredictable. You don't know what tomorrow may bring to your life. Rain falls on the righteous and the unrighteous. Trouble and blessings come to everyone. Death comes to both. He concludes that wisdom and or possessions will not extend a life. The work and creations of a man are not enduring and will be forgotten with the passage of time. A wise man and a fool will both die. They're like the wind. They're fleeting. And again, life doesn't progress in a straight line. We can't manipulate things to avoid all adversity. No matter how wise you may be, hardship comes to the wise and to the fool. The statement in verse 17, which says, "So I hated life," is not showing the preacher's dislike for the life he was given, but it shows his dislike for the life he created. Ecclesiastes 7:29. "Behold, I have found only this, that God made people upright, but they have sought out many schemes." If we want to look at this, we might be able to understand what he's saying is man was created in the image of the Creator, according to Genesis. But sin and disobedience along the lines of gratifying the flesh has taken its negative toll on the lives of people. These are the schemes of men. It's a conclusion that has become apparent to the preacher after all the things he's previously stated. His decisions to emphasize the creation of fabulous structures and gardens and to marry many wives and to build temples, it didn't help him avoid a life in pieces. His work will be left to others to either enjoy, destroy, or watch it decay and be forgotten. It sounds like he saw his life and his earthly pursuits to be unfulfilling as he approached his twilight years. Simply said, you can't control life. Both wonderful and harsh experiences will come your way. Death is an unavoidable ending because of man's fall into sin, which he terms schemes. That is the outcome for man. What man creates will decay and be forgotten. God's creation is good, and obedience to him is restorative. Be obedient and honor God. So how did Solomon come to this realization? Well, God spoke to Solomon in 1 Kings 11:11. "So the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this, and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and will give it to your servant." How devastating that would be to hear God tell you that. When you think that you have the life under the sun and the heavens figured out, something happens and you no longer have a firm hold on a temporary life. Good and bad things happen to good and bad people under the sun. The only consistency the preacher sees is God's creation. Ecclesiastes 1:4-5. "One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteneth to his place where he arose. The rivers flow, the wind blows, the sun rises and sets according to God's schedule. Generations come and generations go. Nevertheless, God has put things in motion that don't pass away with age." The phrase "under the sun" helps us understand the temporary condition of fallen man in contrast to the consistent, permanent creation of God, which gives all mankind eternal pleasure and happiness. God's arrangement in heaven is fixed and permanent and is under his control. The second reality is simply stated, you can't change fallen evil world to make a better life. Only God can do that. God is restorative. There's an interesting observation in Ecclesiastes 3. Let me read for you. And this is a very well-known series of scriptures. And it's kind of titled, "A Time for Everything." And we start with verse 3. "There is an appointed time for everything." Who I'm sorry. Did I miss something here? No. Okay. There is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every event under heaven, a time to give birth and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to throw stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to shun embracing, a time to search and a time to give up as lost, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear apart and a time to sew together, a time to be silent and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. Solomon's saying, there is no straight line in life. There's good things happen and bad things happen. That's the way life is. The preacher looks at all positive things in his life as a gift. He begins by explaining that there's a time for everything. There's a time for hardships in life, and there's a time to enjoy the free gifts from God. You're a temporary steward of God's gifts under the sun. Everything you have is a gift from God. God's arrangement in heaven is fixed and permanent and is under his control. We look forward to the kingdom where we will see what God sees. Is the preacher pointing to another life lesson in chapter 3 that's important for us? I'd say yes. There is a time for everything. When life is going well, we should expect that there is a time coming when things don't go so well. And then the good time returns, and then that ends. This is the tempo and the progression of life under the sun. It's a rhythm. There is a rhythm which controls every living thing under the sun. We should remember that rhythm when there are good times and bad, because we have to realize that even this shall pass. The rhythm and the beat of life goes on. Rejoice in the free gifts from God that will lift you up after the hardness in life ends. Harsh experiences prepare you for greater rejoicing. Ecclesiastes 3:10-15. I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He's also set eternity in their heart, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. It is the gift of God. And I know that everything God does will remain forever. There's nothing to add to it, and there is nothing to take from it. For God has so worked that men should fear him. That which it has been already, and that which will be, has already been. For God seeks what has passed by. There's nothing new under the sun. There's two types of wisdom. And I think that's what Solomon is kind of getting to. There's worldly wisdom, there's spiritual wisdom. When we appreciate the gifts of God, we're exercising our spiritual wisdom. If we only appreciate the work of our hands and we fail to give God the honor and glory for what we have been given, then we're using worldly wisdom. The time that we eat and drink is a time that we focus on God's daily provision for us. It is an appreciation of the gift of God. The preacher repeats this point throughout his life lessons in Ecclesiastes to make the reader aware of the value of being appreciative for the work of our hands in the gathering and serving of food that was provided by the grace of God. Let me read a few scriptures here that point to that. Ecclesiastes 2:24, there is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen that it is from the hand of God. Ecclesiastes 3:13. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor, it is the gift of God. Ecclesiastes 5:18. Here is what I have seen to be good and fitting, to eat, to drink, and enjoy oneself in all one's labor in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him, for this is his reward. Ecclesiastes 8:18. So I commended pleasure, for there is nothing good for a man under the sun except to eat, to drink, and be merry, and this will stand by him in his toils throughout the days of his life, which God has given him under the sun. Ecclesiastes 9:7. Go then, eat your bread in happiness and drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has already approved your works. We must be thankful for the grandest banquet or the tiniest morsel of food, because it is the goodness which comes from the hand of God. In this cursed world, we may not have great riches like Solomon, but we are cared for by God. The riches are temporary. The provisions by God are assured. The book of 1 Timothy would agree with Solomon. 1 Timothy 6:8. If we have food and covering with these, we shall be content. No scripture says that the riches and possessions of this world under the sun are guaranteed to anyone. Their longevity may be for a season, and then they fade with time. They are vanity, hevel. But the grace and love of God is eternal. I hope that we can have a better understanding of Solomon's wisdom on this subject of a life that should have led him to be closer to God, but fell victim to the temptations of a cursed world under the sun. Solomon's life, as he saw it, laying in pieces in front of him, gave him a perspective that prepared him for an opportunity to teach people how to avoid the pitfalls in life that does not utilize God's godly wisdom and knowledge to steer their life. Ecclesiastes 12:9. In addition to being a wise man, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, and he pondered, searched out, and arranged many proverbs. And may the Lord add his blessing.